So what we're going to see today is prototype programming. We want to first introduce a few basic language features as they differ a little bit from what we have seen from the last few lectures. Then we're going to look at how structured data is handled in a prototype-based language. And then we're going to look at how we can implement something like code reusage in such an environment. And last of all, we're going to see how something like the object-oriented ideas that we have seen in the last few slides can be kind of simulated or imitated. So that's what we're going to do today. So the core or the essence of something like the prototype-based languages is to go away from a static type system as it is intended for something like scripting or rapid application development. So the fundamental question that people are asking if they just want to do a small script or just a few lines of code is, why should I even bother to come up with a type structure, which is quite complicated, if I just want to use this specific object only once in my code? Or why should I bother with all that complicated things that we've seen the last few times if it's just a quick hack and I'm going to re-implement it anyway in another language as soon as I have just done my prototype and have, prototype is a bad word in that context because it's overloaded, but even if I have created my first proof of concept and then I'm going to move on to something more suitable for stable development. So why should I even bother with types? Of course, that's quite controversial, but I'm going to see that it has a few nice implications also. So that's it's once again a few of the pros and cons for such an approach. So there's, first of all, the key thing with which I started is, if I only use my objects as singletons anyway, if I start first implementing type, which is kind of opening a set of different values that then fill the singleton, the classes, and then only going to use it with one object, that looks a little bit silly. Also, if I look at common source code, if I do my typing in a real serious way, then I will probably also try to get the type parameters right, and there will be a lot of problems with co and contra variants. All of that just won't bother us at all if we don't fiddle around with types and just use plain objects instead. So that's the next thing. So these complicated things like generic types, we won't even bother with them. We will just rely on that we get it right the first time. And also, we might be able to avoid the redundancy that the type systems of the languages that we've seen for the last few times impose on us by just don't do any types at all. So that's the bothersome features of types that we might want to get rid of. So what's the alternative for all that? The idea then would be to just start my implementation by creating kind of code that can be seen as an example of what I'm going to do with my objects. So I just start implementing without any planning of my data structures first. I'm going to restrict myself to very basic concepts with that. There's only little set of things that I will be able to use in there, but that might be something like back to the basics that's something that has its own merits, I would say. Then there's a thing that even though there's only basic concepts by default, if I at some point really decide that I need the complexity, I might start to introduce it myself, but only by need. So we're going to see that there is ways to introduce structured data types there, and there's there are ideas out there for sharing code and implementations, but I don't have to use them, and they are not present from the beginning, and I can introduce them as soon as I need them. And the general idea is then that I can shape the language features to my own desire. So I can create the features in these languages as I like them to be. So there's several prototype-based languages out there. The one that I've chosen here is one that I've chosen because of its popularity as a kind of a scripting language for larger systems. So Lua is one of the languages which is present and in a lot of, for example, gaming engines where you have where you can provide scripts of what certain levels should look like and certain actions that should occur at some point. So is there any other language for prototype-based programming out there that you know? So JavaScript, for example? Someone particularly involved in JavaScript programming? Okay, Lua, anyone? Nobody? Okay, that's a novelty for that lecture. But anyway, then we're going to see how that works, and everyone will be newbie for that, so that also has its merits. Okay, so let's probably start with the basic language features. So the very basics is, well, of course, statements and expressions. So in the beginning, it's all looking very familiar, so I can do my expressions in the kind of C way, so I program them just ordinarily, and I can perform assignments with my assignment operator, and I finish my statement with a semicolon. However, I don't necessarily have to do so. I can even put statements one after each other, as long as I somehow separate them in a kind of unique way. I can do comments, so that's no surprise there. There's also the complex one, multiline comment. I put them there, the multiline comment here, because it has a kind of a unusual appearance. And yeah, afterwards I'll continue with ordinary assignments. So a sequence of that type of things is called chunks. So a chunk is a sequence of statements. Then next thing is what are the things that I'm going to store into my variables with assignments. And therefore, we need to talk a little bit about values and types. For Lua, as for many other prototype languages, there's dynamical types involved. So we don't necessarily have any type definitions. So that's what dynamical types usually are. In the implementation, that means that each of the values actually carries some kind of flag that tags the value with the corresponding type. And I can access the whole thing via a language construct called type, and that returns a string representation of a values type. So let's have a look at how that is occurring in language. So an ordinary assignment is just, well, for example, this A is true, and then I can access the type information for the whole thing via just the expression type A, which will yield me a Boolean here. I will also be able to do that on constants. For example, that is one constant that, well, compile time, probably you can even compute the constant value. A little bit surprising is here that what you get out of that is actually a number. So the plus is a fixed operator for addition, and it will force every one of its operands to behave like a number. So 42 will be converted to a number in this case. If I want to do the thing that, for example, the Java programmers would have intended with a plus, I should rather use the concatenation operator like this, which will then generate Simon 1 as a string. Good. Then the next thing is that I can now try to be crazy and have a look at what the type of type actually is. And, well, functions are also types, so that's also what you can get as values. This is actually quite important, as you can just assign ordinary types to ordinary values, ordinary functions to certain variables. So functions are kind of first-class citizens in the whole thing, and they're treated just as ordinary values in that context. Then we come to a very special thing, which is this nil. Nil is a value that occurs if you try to refer to certain things or try to access certain things that are not really present. In these cases, you will get nil as a value, and nil is also the type for the value nil. So nil is both of that, and that's what you'll get if you query for the value for the type of nil. Good. Then there's also ways to directly incorporate HTML code into the whole Lua system, and this will be just treated as a string, so that's not too surprising. The next thing that comes for free if you start with these kind of dynamic languages is that although you have used the A in the past already as a, in this case, a Boolean, you will be able to change its type by just assigning something different. The type is attached to the value and not to the to the variable. So in this case, I can just reassign something different as long as it's still a value to my variable, and this will make the type query to something different. So we'll get number as the type for A as opposed to over here where we got Boolean. So that might change in our code at when we run it. Okay, so far nothing too complex, I would say. Yeah, next thing, functions. I somehow need to create modules of code that I can pass around and execute somewhere else. So for the purpose, we introduce our functions. So there's a certain syntax to create functions, and that's what you see here. So you start a function with keyword function and stop it with end, and you have to give certain components for that. There's the name for this function, which is treated as kind of a variable at that position. So you in this language you kind of give the variable pretty print the value of the function that you're defining here. So it's just another way of introducing a variable here. Then there's the parameters, which introduce new names that you can use in the function body then, and you will return whatever you will do in there. So what you can do with that now is that you can take the value from PrettyPrint and access it the same way as a variable name and assign it to somewhere else. And from that other place, you can then actually call the whole thing with the semantics that you are quite used to. So you just put the braces around and have the parameters there, and you call the function. And yeah, it's actually also other ways to introduce new functions to somewhere, and that's the version that you see over here, which does something quite similar as before. You, in this case, you introduce an anonymous function, so there's no name for the function directly given. Instead, you will use the syntax that makes it explicit that you actually perform an assignment, and that the anonymous function is treated as a value in that context. So that's what you see over here. So you assign the anonymous function to the PrettyPrint variable. So, but both of these are valid ways of specifying functions. Okay. So far, it's just very, very basic control structures. So now we should have a look at how data structures are actually introduced into the whole system. So for that, also we're pretty minimalistic in Lua. There's only one way of introducing complex data types. And that is, in principle, just having kind of maps or hash tables or whatever you want to call them, partial functions. In principle, you realize them on the language level as hash tables or lookup tables or anything that gives you that interface. So you can index in to access the values of such a structure. You can do so with arbitrary values. So you can use numbers, characters, strings, whatever, and all of them are used to look up something in your table. And of course, as it is common for tables, they can grow arbitrarily large, and they are shrinking and growing as you use them, depending on how you use them. So what is the actual syntax in Lua for achieving that? So first of all, let's have a look at how such a structure is born. And you create an empty table with just the empty brackets, curly brackets for that. Yeah, and then you already have your structure and you can start to use it. So let's do that. And we were promised to be able to access the slots in that data structure with arbitrary values. So let's create such an arbitrary value. And we store that in K for key. And yeah, let's use it. So what the typical syntax to do so is, well, you can use it, for example, like this, in kind of an array fashion. So with that, you will access the lookup table at key 42, because that's the value that K has. Okay. Of course, you can, you can also use the K as a value to assign to the whole thing, but to make matters a little bit more interesting, let's this time not use the K explicitly, but let's store, for example, the string, use the string K as our key. We can also do so with just the array syntax, so it's not a real array syntax. You don't need to provide a number there. You can also use strings. in case you get sick or tired from the from one of these entries, you can remove them, and that's performed by assigning nil to any of these key entries inside the lookup table, and with that you will remove the particular entry. So in this case, what we've done is we've removed the entry at position 42. And now the thing that comes or is well that you will notice at several points of this introduction to Lua is that Lua introduces a lot of syntactic sugar for things that you could express with other means anyway. So that's what's happening over here. For example, we have that axis over here now, not with the with the square brackets to access the slot within the A, but this time we use this dot operator, and what that will do is it will take the identifier that is found right to the right of the operator as a string and use that this string to access our hash table. So this will not actually access the hash table at point at the key 42, but instead it will use the identifier's lexical identity, which is the string K, and look up at that key. So that was your question. You mean this one?
Yes.
This will be treated as the number 42.
Then you can, for example, specify not a number but an object as a key.
I'm actually not quite sure what happens if you use an object as a key. It might also try to convert that into a string before looking it up. But that's one of the points that I'm not actually sure. I would have to try that out. Maybe some of you has the virtual machine open with a Lua interpreter running. I haven't tried that, but it might be interesting to see what happens there. Okay. Yes, please. Well, that depends completely on the implementation of your virtual machine. So there's not one Lua virtual machine, but several implementations. And it might, well, there's also other hash tables that cope with collisions, and then we'll just probably use some kind of linear list or whatever. I'm not sure. Well, I would say if there's just hash values involved, you might still be able to define some kind of basic equality test or something. I'm not exactly sure how they do it on that level, but they seem to do quite fine. So maybe they use just the addresses of the functions or something, but I'm sure you can figure something like that out. I'm also not quite sure whether that is really defined in the language. It's not that there's a kind of a real large standard paper out there which gives you particular knowledge of how you have to implement that particular low-level feature. So it's more on the high-level features. So yeah. Don't really know. Maybe you would just as soon as hash values seem to be the same, you might then start to branch with based on something different, or just have a linked list and check for equality or something. I'm not so sure. Anyway, that's already quite deep into the whole thing. In principle, what you get is these types of accesses to your data structure entries. So, what is the life cycle of such a table? You can create it just from scratch, as we have seen already. So, you just generate it as an empty table, and then you can modify that and pass the reference to the table around. So it's actually considered to be assignments are kind of done by reference. So if I modify, well, that's probably just the initial entry that you would pass in there, and then we assign the reference to this particular table over to the variable b, we will then have essentially two references to the same table. So if I then try to access the k key of my variable b, then I will get when I will actually modify the same slot as I had before. So this will set the whole thing. And if I then try to access my old reference at the same location, then I will still I won't get the value that I've passed into the whole system over here, but instead I will get directed this entry. Then I can also remove references to tables by just assigning the nil value to the variables or something different, some basic values or so, and with that I will remove one of the references to the table, but still there will be the reference that resides in B, so I can then access the whole thing still from B, and as soon as I remove that, I kind of need to garbage collect the old table. So in that case, I cannot refer to that table anymore with the links that I have here. So that's not too surprising so far. Let's start composing our types in some way. And for that, there's a special feature in these types of languages that allows you to somehow interfere with the inner workings of dispatching and somehow connecting objects. And Lua, for that purpose, introduces something which is called the metatables. So these things. Well, what is a metatable? First of all, a metatable is created the same way as ordinary tables. So a metatable is an ordinary table, at least in one aspect. And they are just used in a very special way. So as metatables are supposed to determine how other tables are used, they act as kind of you can place hooks into them. You can place your callback methods for certain situations that may happen to other tables into these meta tables. And depending on what names you choose for the functions that you refer from your meta table, you will be called at the different situations. So there's naming conventions for special functions that you can provide via meta tables. So you need to pay them respect. Then the next part is that you somehow need to connect your table that you've created with your special callback code to the original table that you wanted to behave in a certain way. And for that, there's a certain system functions that you need to call, which will then hook your meta tables into other tables. For that, you can use this set meta table, or you might retrieve a meta table via get meta table. And if you connect a meta table prepared with the right callback methods that are stored under the same or under the right names, you will be able to change the behavior of the targets for which you set this meta table. And well, let's probably have a look at how that looks in an example. So first of all, let's mark the two tables that we create here. So we will create one table over here and another table over there. The first table, the one that's empty at the beginning, this one here, this is the one that we are gonna use as the meta table for the one that we create further down, which is this one. So meta is meant to act as the meta table for A. It's just, well, it doesn't need to be called meta. I just do that to give you a hint what its purpose actually should be. I can now introduce special methods that I will assign to special keys within the meta table in order to achieve certain behavior of my table A. So what I can, for example, customize is the way that the conversion to string or to text is happening. For that, I will have to use a special name for the key under which I introduce my method. So you'll see here. Here is the place where I specify the variable where my function will be accessible. For that, I use now the identifier underscore underscore toString, which is one of these special naming convention, or well, that pays respect to a certain naming convention. This toString method is exactly the callback for the conversion to a string. What I also do is, well, we haven't done that before yet, but we have used this syntax where I use my assignment to as an entry under the key toString of the table meta already inside the name for the function. So that's just an abbreviation for what, actually? Well, it's just the same as using meta dot toString is the same as, and then continuing with the anonymous function of whatever parameter and so on. So that's just syntactic sugar. Promised you that there will be a lot of sugar around. Okay, so that's how I specify my toString method, and it's also a convention that it has to be declared with one parameter here. Okay, here I can perform. Yes, please. Meta is referring to the empty table that we have introduced before, yes. So that is the same meta as this one. It's not a keyword. Okay, and the thing is that it is supposed to work on a parameter, and with that I can try to access things. So far we don't know anything about the parameter, we don't have any types here, so we just rely on person being some kind of hash table, and the way that this is supposed to work is that I try to access the prefix entry of that certain hash table and the name entry of that certain lookup table, and I will concatenate that and use the whole thing as my output. Yeah.
Have the same attributes as in the first one, and then we apply a set meta table twice for the first meta table and for the second.
Mm-hmm.
Will that be overwritten?
Yes. I can overwrite meta tables via that set meta table thing, yes. That's what I was going to do next. So the function is pretty simple so far, so I think I don't need to explain it anymore. But then there's the next component that you've already started to look at, which is the set meta table, which would then have the purpose to connect those together. So what I would do with that is I would install meta as the meta table for A with that method call, which would be, well, you can kind of imagine the whole thing to be realized with an internal key that cannot be accessed in any other way, that actually stores the reference to the meta table in the same way as the ordinary key value pairs would be stored. And as the set meta table would just be the accessor for setting that specific entry in the table. So if you call it just another way, you would overwrite the value that you would have had before. And you could also remove any meta table by just setting nil as your meta table. Or yourself, or, well, you'll see that later on. And now, if I use another system given function like this print, what that will do is it will try to print on your console a textual representation of the thing that you give to it. And for structures, what it will do is it will try to look up whether there is some kind of toString function registered for your object, and in case that there is one of them, it will actually call it. Otherwise, it will do something different, depending on how your runtime system is working. So, what will happen in this case is that if it tries to convert your object to string, it will actually perform the lookup via the meta table, and there is the your custom code to string. So that will be looked up in the meta table of the object A, and it will be called with the actual targeted table as a parameter. So this A will be given to the toString method in order to get my textual representation. So what will be done is, well, we will get a lookup of person prefix, and now that we know that how the complete flow of the whole thing is, we will realize that at least at that point where toString is called, we will know that the parameter will be actually A, and A is the table that has an entry for prefix, which is in this case doctor, and we'll have also an entry for name. This will be resolved like this. So person is in that context referring to the table from A. And in the same fashion as we've seen here, there's also other operators that you can use in order to customize the behavior of your language. So you can kind of overload operators in a similar way as you can do in C++, for example. So there's conventions like these names over here, where you can, with add, you can overload the behavior at if there's a binary expression with the add operator for multiplication, subtraction, division, and all the other things here, you can overload the operators. There's also comparatives that you can overload. So far, also things that are not too new, that's things that you can also do in other languages. But the thing that is giving us now a little bit more is a very special key that's called index, and that is the entry to the world of delegation. Delegation means that we will be now talking about delegating the lookup of certain keys from one table to another, or to some to. Well, you can also register something completely different there, but we'll see that now. So if we now use the key underscore underscore index in our meta table, we will now get access to a certain situation, which is the situation where, that will happen as soon as I, as the interpreter fails to find a value under a certain name in, during a lookup. So in these cases, we have seen that in principle, nil would be returned to the user. However, or to the looker-upper. But in our case, that when we actually register something under this index keyword, we will be now in control of the situation. So I can perform something in case that the name lookup actually fails. So there's also further conventions. There's not only just the plain name, but also, as we have seen for the toString before, there's conventions for the signature. I need parameters like the receiver table and the key. Those are the two parameters that I also expect to get when I introduce such an index thing. And yeah, in case that I then do very special things like, for example, then relaying this lookup to another table, then that is the concept of delegation. So what does that mean in example code? Let's have a look. So once again, we have a situation where we have several tables involved. We now have the plain old meta table that we're still calling meta over here. Then there's other tables that will act as our targets or receivers of lookups, especially the one that I will finally then be working with is this person thing. And in our case, I have decided that I want to kind of modularize our person, and I'm gonna introduce a separate representation to store everything that's job-related. So I will have another one of our tables here. So now is the question, how can I connect them to each other? So first of all, what I'm going to do is I will introduce the index thing into our meta table. So I will set the index entry of the meta table. And by convention, we have that we have to interpret the receiver table somehow and also the key. So these are the two parameters that I need to somehow receive. And yeah, in order to get something like delegation, I can do, for example, this. I can now access our receiver of the whole lookup. So this would be the same receiver that has had problems with resolving the key that is given to us via the second parameter. And what I'm going to do in my customized version of method lookup, I will not look this key up directly in the original receiver table, but instead what I'm going to do is I will forward the lookup to another thing, which is this prototype thing. And how do I get my prototype thing? I will look it up in my original receiver. So what my customized version of the lookup here does is, instead of looking it up locally in my original receiver, I'm going to relay it. I don't necessarily need to relay to something which I store in my original receiver. I could also choose some kind of static location or whatever. But in that case, in that particular case, I'm going to relay to a different, a specific table, which I get via the original receiver. So in this case, I'm going to look up my key in the prototype field of my original table. So if I then use that as my meta table, I will somehow have to look at how this is supposed to be used. So of course, I'm going to somehow have to set meta as the meta table for the person. And the actual data structure layout of my targeted tables is that the person has a slot for the actual name, and there's also this dubious prototype key that will link to, in this case, another table. This refers to another one of these tables, which is this job table. And in the job table, I have now an accessor for the prefix. So in case that I now call print on my person, we've learned that in this case, what's going to happen is that print will directly try to convert the parameter that it gets to textual representation via looking inside of the meta table for the entry to string. So this will dispatch to metas to string, and this will call. This will also give this reference to person over into this parameter by convention. So what's going to happen now is that the first dispatching is done. Now I need to still execute my conversion. That's going to happen via concatenation of strings, and I'm going to concatenate two things, the person.name and the person.prefix. So I'm going to start with probably not the obvious one, but instead the person's dot name. So for lookup of name, we're still going to use person. So let's have a lookup of name within person. And oh, surprise, surprise, we'll see there's actually a name stored in person. And it's going to be Simon. So, well, that has immediately succeeded. No need for calling the index method because we have a successful lookup. Everything's fine from here, and we can continue with the other resolution. In this case, it's the resolution of person.prefix. And looking at the person map, we'll see that, well, actually, there's nothing like prefix in there. So what's going to happen is, in this case, we will get a call to the index method here because our name lookup has failed. In this case, what's going to happen is that we're going to get the original person. Well, I probably have to get rid of that. I'm going to get the original person as the receiver for which the lookup has failed. And I'm going to get the, which one was it? The prefix over, come on. I'm going to get the prefix over here as the key for which the resolution has failed. So what will happen here in our implementation is that table, which is the original person, is going to be going to have a lookup for prototype. And prototype is something that we're going to be able to actually look up. This will refer to job. So what we're going to do here is we're going to have a lookup for key inside job. And, well, that's what we're going to get here. Prefix within job will have doctor as value. And that's going to be returned from the index thing, which will then be used over here together with the assignment that we got from the other lookup. So that's how the delegation actually works. This might be a little bit easier for you if... Yes, please?
The next is called when you fail your first lookup.
When you fail the lookup, yes, please. Yeah. Well, that depends on whether or how your... I should probably have a look back. This index has been called because it has been registered for a certain table over here with the set meta table. It has been registered particularly for the person table. I've done nothing with a in this case with a job table. So I would still be able to install another meta table that I might create somewhere else and then install it as set meta table to job in this case. And then you would have this lookup hook on two levels. First, the first one would react, and then it would dispatch to the other table. And depending on what is registered there as index, there might be happening something different.
So, if you want to do some sort of composition on one level, like you want to what's the case of the person on the object of the person, you want to let's say inherit. From multiple sources, so one might be your prototype, so you define that in your index. But the second one, like the only way to use another object in that same structure would be in your index function to start checking your access, and then either access prototype or the other table that you want to define.
Well, that's actually still another way of doing it, which we're going to see an implementation of that very close to the end. But you can just, for example, you can just try to dispatch to a certain table, and in case that dispatch fails completely, you can still look up somewhere else because you have your whole function body here that you can use. So, in case you get no valid answer from the first candidate, you can still implement another lookup somewhere else. So with that, you might be able to install several parents. Yeah. Okay. So that's the situation in kind of a table-based diagram where I just one of these boxes each of these boxes is its own table. So I have the table for person, the table for meta, and the table for job, and that's the situation that you get after having created all the particular tables and connected them via set meta table. So you would have to imagine that very special entry underscore underscore meta to be something internal, and there you would kind of store your meta table entry. So that's the cause for this reference over here, and then there's also the plain ordinary key prototype. That's the one that it's actually not treated any different from, for example, the name entry. And the only thing is it's just a reference to another table. And the main important thing why that is something important is because of the way that we have implemented the index. So that should kind of designate function addresses. So that's the addresses that I also kind of annotate here in order to make it more clear which of the ones that are actually which of the ones are actually meant. So at the index position, I have a reference to that particular implementation of my of an index function, and that is gonna specifically delegate to the prototype table. Okay, so that's just another way of depicting the whole thing. So let's continue a little bit on the way to delegation. The thing is that I don't necessarily need to provide the entry for index as a function. I can also just put a reference to a hash table directly in there, as hash tables can be accessed in the same way with first the first pointer being kind of a reference to something that I can ask for giving me something for in return for a value. So that's something that I can directly use in order to implement the same thing without having to manually code a delegation function. Because that is something that is that's going to be used a lot of times in a similar way. I would just use a table to dispatch in many situations. And for that, I can just directly store my table in there. So the same example once again with now our advanced delegation system is, well, I still need to introduce a meta table, but the meta table now is only carrying the toString method for, well, whatever purpose. But now, instead of having to specify another dispatching function, what I can do is I can just set the index entry to specifically that table, which is in this case the job table, and this will already suffice, well, at least as soon as I have set the meta table as the meta table. Okay, yeah. So in terms of graphical layout, this will change things a little bit up, and now I don't need to carry my prototype reference with me in my own object or in my own table, but instead I can carry it within the meta table. So the, instead of having my job reference in here, I will instead have it over here, because, well, I'm gonna delegate to that table anyway. So, yeah, just syntactic sugar, so to say. So the next step in delegation is that I not only I'm not only able to delegate in case of or customize delegation in case of read access. I can only I can also do so in case of access with intention to write. So for these kinds of actions, I can have. I can establish a new function in case of an unresolvable or an update to an unresolvable entry, and in this case we don't we have a situation that has even more data that is connected. So there's several parameters for that. There's the target table, which has failed to resolve, the key, and the value that I originally wanted to store in there is also given in order that we can do something else with that value. So that is something that you can, for example, use in order to implement something like a gatekeeper or a write protection to something. So that's what we're going to do here. So once again, we're doing persons here, and persons are created over, well, first of all, let's highlight all the tables that are involved. So there's an ominous data table that I'm creating here inside of the persons table. And also there's, as usual, our meta table. And they are afterwards connected with that. And also, I'm going to use the this ominous data table as the table that is responsible for lookups that actually originally happened within the persons table and has failed. Also, I introduce the new index entry in the meta table, which is evaluating to an to a function, and yeah, that is a function that is actually well, we can use it as kind of a write protection to our table in a way that is freely configurable. For example, in our case, what we want is we dealing with persons. Well, there might be persons that we don't want to be able to modify something related to the person. So we might kind of fix this condition in some way. So what we have here is a certain evaluation where we fix that if in case that the key that was intended to be changed has a certain one, which in this case the title key, and in case that the name that is set in our table so far has a certain value, then we might deny that special person to actually somehow modify their title. And in the other way, we might just allow this value to be passed through. But in this case, the data part of our table. So yeah, that's kind of keeping all the attributes not within the ordinary person, but instead within the this inner table called data. And as we have an as we don't have any entries in the original persons table, we will in any way, if someone wants to access our table, we'll in any way get the callback for that, and we'll be able to interfere with whatever we want to do at that case. So that is kind of the thing that we can go for here. Of course, that is just a very, very naive implementation of that. And you can, with the right function calls, you can just pass around that thing in the real implementation. But it should give you an intention of what you an intuition of what you can actually do with such things. Yes.
Is it
underscore index, and then you have your file, which is underscore new index.
Might be so, yeah. Why not? Yeah, you can map that to just plain hash tables and their access functions. Yeah, that would be one way of implementing a Lua interpreter into your personal software project. So that's actually something we have tried that as a student's project in a practical course once, and people got bored after 10 days because, well, it just... You can implement that kind of language really fast. And in the end, they ended up with implementing the whole system library for Lua also, because there were just, well, there was nothing to do for just the ordinary language. So it's really fast to implement, because you can almost directly map that to your hosting language, if it already supports something like hash tables. You just have to come up with a clever hashing function and some representation of your values, and you're done. So it's, yeah, it's also a simple parser for that. So it's a really quick way to get a customization into your software project, and that's probably why a lot of these gaming engines have that or something similar as a scripting language. And probably also other, I think in image manipulation software, you also have similar scripting languages. So it's not only the gaming industry. Anyway, so now that we've seen a few of the basic mechanisms of delegation working, we can now try to come up with ways to kind of get something pretty similar to software modularization as we had with our beloved objects in the past. So I think you were already in your head trying to arrange everything so that you can get something like objects. But yeah, that's what we're going to develop now from slide to slide from now on. So far, we have only had ideas for designing objects that we would immediately then use, and they would also be able to access all the data that they could find, and we were not actually able to discern different or particular objects from each other with still being able to share the code somehow and still disambiguate the data. So are there ways to achieve something like controlled sharing and disambiguation? Well, you can, for example, do it like this. So let's start to develop a way to handle banking accounts. Of course, you would definitely want to implement your banking software in Lua, so let's do write that. So, for example, I would like to somehow represent accounts. So, for that, I would start off with a map that or a table that will map the key balance to my actual balance, which is of course zero. I always spend everything that I get. So, of course, that's also a good way to start from for the bank. So then there's, of course, actions that are associated with a banking account. For example, I would like to do something like withdrawing a certain value from my account. For that, I would somehow need to subtract this value from my balance and make it my new balance. And of course, I also want to somehow tell what's still left on my account. So for that purpose, I introduce a toString method for the account. And yeah, for that, I would just look up balance in account. And Yeah. Of course, the string methods somehow need to be registered for other objects as the meta table, and as we're being lazy here, we would let the account act as meta table for itself. That's also possible. So what would happen in that case is that the system, as soon as we print the account, of course not not before we withdraw $10 that we don't have from our account, we would then do the print of the account, which would lead to our usual chain, looking up the meta table for account, which happens to be once again account, very nice. So we can call, have a look within account itself whether there's a toString method, which is in case, which is quite fortunate and nice. So we can call that, and this will actually look up balance directly by name. So that is one possibility, but that will lead everybody to share his account or with each other. So that's, yes, there's just no concept of keeping things apart from each other within that. So let's have a second try. And for that, we would kind of have to deal with something like the identity of an object to keep it apart from someone else. And for that, what we would then introduce is a new parameter for the relevant methods that, yeah, so, and this parameter would carry the actual table that carries the data on which I want to actually work. So we rewrite our example, and it would go like this. Actually, I think you could probably also remove that one. I'm not sure why it's still there. So it's probably superfluous. So what I introduce newly to my implementation is that I now have a parameter for the account, and I do my computations and also my information based on the parameter instead of my original account table. So we go away from our original table to a parametric implementation. And still, I will I would do something like indexing everything that I don't find. I would index relative to account, so I will delegate to account. So account is now not only acting as the carrier for withdraw and toString, but also as the delegation target for, well, whatever comes after. So now we introduce another account, or something that will serve as account from now on, which is this gyro thing, gyro, don't know, and it carries a balance like zero over here. And what we can do now is we can connect the account as the meta table to gyro, which will then act as provider for everything that we can't resolve directly on Jira, which will mean that we will, well, how does that work? Because, well, the account is registered as the delegation target within itself, and as account is used as the meta table for Jira, we will have specified with that that account is going to act as the delegation target for the Jira thing. Okay, and with that, we will have introduced the method withdraw and the method toString that comes from account, and that will be called whenever I can't resolve the keys withdraw and toString in Jira itself. So with that, I can now start having fun with accounts. So for example, I can withdraw $10 from Jira, and that directly works. I can access withdraw from account, and I give driver to it to act as the target for subtraction. Of course, I can also do something like this, which will then use our delegation principles to access the withdraw method, although gyro not directly specified withdraw. This will still work fine. However, it bothers us a little bit to have to specify gyro twice. First of all, as the table from which I take the implementation of withdraw, and second, to take gyro as the first parameter in order to implement the access to the data that I carry within gyro. And once again, there's syntactic sugar, as I've promised, and this syntactic sugar is just the colon over here, and this will be actually just the same thing as the line above. So this is just syntactic sugar for this one. So gyro, if you use it with this colon, will be copied to two places. It will go for once to the front of the method as the target or the receiver of this call, and as well it will be prepended to the list of parameters that have been originally passed there. And yeah, this is just a convenient way of kind of simulating object access to the whole thing as if it had been object orientation like this. So yeah, with that, well, that's probably this one's probably the reason why I have given the account its own balance. That's just to demonstrate that this two string over here will still map or will still do the output of the old balance, and our new gyro will then map to this balance, which has been modified a few times, so it has kind of added up a few of these withdrawals already. Yes, please.
If, for example, in table.
Yes, in this case, if there would have been an empty table, then we of course would still resolve all the accesses to the balance that we have introduced in the account, which is something which we don't really desire. So we're in this implementation here, we're still depending on the user knowing how to prepare its data structure before usage. So, well, that's just giving you the table view on the whole thing, but it's not giving you any new information. It's just that the index refers to the table itself. But what you asked is, well, there's still the situation that we need to give our own balance to the whole system. But the idea is, why should I let the system, let the user actually perform his or her creation of the data structures? I should probably also take care of that within my original account thing in order to get some kind of instance that prepares everything and offers all the functionality in terms of it brings its functions into the game. So that's what we're going to do with the account now. And now we have emptied the representation of the account. So account will then act as the provider for the data layout and the method implementations, which is somehow something that resembles already our classes quite a lot. So also you see that the implementation here is pretty much the same as it has been before, with a few exceptions. Here, that's the syntactic sugar, and in this case, it's acting kind of similar as it had on the function call level. This means that actually the method that we specify here has another parameter that's not explicitly mentioned and can be accessed within the method code via self. So that's the corresponding thing to this reference in other languages. And you can only use that if you have specified your method in that way. Okay, so what else is happening here? Now the account is also responsible for creating the data structures that will be used with the whole thing. And I do that by implementing, well, I of course explicitly chose this this name because it should remind you of the constructor that you have in the object-oriented systems, but you could freely take the name that you would like the whole thing to have. You could choose create or construct or whatever you would like, or even use something like trireme or banana or whatever you would like to call it. It's not fixed. You can choose that for yourself. And I've implemented it in a way that it actually takes is able to receive some kind of prepared data structure as the template, so you can call it with something as the parameter, which would then be used as the final target for our object calls. However, you don't necessarily have to. That's what this OR operator does, so that's a little bit of magic. It decides whether template is a valid value that was given to the method via parameter, and if not, then it will just choose this balanced thing over here. If you absolutely want to prevent the system from tinkering with the internals of the data structure, like the balance being not there, you would probably remove this template from here and here and just initialize the template with balance is zero. Then the next thing is that template will get a method table installed, and for that purpose we take self. Well, what is self meant to be? You are meant to, in the end, call your new method with account as target, so account will be the one that will be used as meta table later on. So that's what this actually will achieve. Then the place where to look for methods that can't be found in our final account representation should be self, which is also once again will evaluate to account. So account will be the place to look for things like withdraw and all the other account important things. And the string method is actually mapped to just the account to string. Well, that's not too important to us right now. So now the account acts as kind of a class for the whole thing, like this. And, well, that's the version where I create a kind of a fake balance with already 10 bucks on there. But, of course, I might not do so, and I might have disallowed the whole thing by having done that. And in this case, it's just the constructor call, and this will then just create a new balance object and or balance table, and in the end return it so that the zero will be initialized with just an empty or zero evaluating balance. Okay, and then I can use the zero table in the way that I'm used to it with from the last slide. So it's just withdraw once again. Okay. So now we have already imitated a lot of the things that we have seen in the last half a year. Now there's also a concept. Well, you can kind of try to also map something like inheritance to this whole thing. Like, for example, you can try to introduce limited accounts, which will try to prevent you from somehow exceeding your limit. So for that, the idea would be to overwrite the implementation of withdraw with something specific. So that's what we're going to do here. We'll introduce the limited account, and the limited account will have another withdraw implementation. Just remember, we haven't provided underscore new index method, so we are still able to put something into the limited account table, and it will not overwrite the things that we have in the original account table because there's still this delegation thing going on. So our original withdrawal method is still found inside the account table. It's just that we have a wrapping table around, which now carries our new implementation of the withdrawal. And within that, we will try to implement a limited account where I can only withdraw until minus, well, whatever. I don't actually know, but that's just some kind of condition that we have added here. And in case that the condition doesn't yield an error, we can still relay further to the account's withdrawal because it's still present here. So now what we can do is we can now create a special Jira with the limited account or with limited accounts new, and this will just I'm actually not sure whether you of course get the new inherited from the old implementation of accounts, so you will be able to implement that. Able to call that, and you will probably in this case, if you call it without anything, well, probably the limit won't actually reach the special Jira in the end. So, yeah, probably I should have initialized with the actual representation over here, or maybe have created some kind of wrapping thing and separated the connection of the new calls, but it's just too much work on the slides here, so let's just leave that away. And in principle, what I wanted to show you is that you have this kind of several layers of classes that you can create by just creating one class that delegates to the other. And yeah, that's probably all that you need to do. Of course, there's also advanced concepts like multiple inheritance, and you have already asked for that, and you can kind of do something like that by just using special purpose delegation functions, and for that you can also write convenient wrappers that wrap together in a generic way to parents in order to form a new child class. So that's what the create child over here is about. So that's a utility method that just is there to connect two parents. And the key idea here is to, once again, provide an indexing function. And you also see me here using the other way of specifying an index function via an anonymous function here. And yeah, that shouldn't shock you too much. And what it actually does is it does a lookup in the first parent's key value pairs, and in case that the value that it got from there is okay, which you can do in the Lua system by just checking for the value. It just checks whether the value is nil or not. And if it is, if it's not nil, then you will just return it. And in case it is nil, then you will probably just continue asking the other parent for its concept of key K. And yeah, with that you can then also provide a new function that will actually connect or create an object that connects with both parents and returns the representation for that. And yeah, that would be a way of doing multiple inheritance, or well, at least dual inheritance. Of course, you can come up with other implementations that will connect to even more parents. That's just an example of how multiple inheritance actually works. Maybe because we have indicated that already a lot of times during the talk, the implementation of Lua is quite simple to do. All you need for representing values is, for once, some idea of the actual type that that the value will have, and there's only a limited number of types. There's numbers, there's booleans, and of course there's tables, and the value itself will then be depending on the actual ID of the type that you've stored in this struct, and it will be depending on that. It will be interpreted in a different way. It might be a number, it might be a boolean, it might be a pointer to a function, or even a garbage collected object, which will be one that represents a hash table, for example. And yeah, you can even think of implementations of Lua that try to give you better performance by separating the entries for that are indexed via number from the entries that are indexed via string, and keeping for one thing, you might keep arrays in order to speed up numerical computations, and still support on the old string lookup. So there's different specialization of the whole thing. But that's a completely different topic, implementation of languages. You could probably visit something like virtual machines next semester for that, because that's the thing that I want to finish with today. If you're more interested in things like that, you should probably, of course, have a look at Lua's documentation. There's also a few papers on that that you can look up. And yeah, with that, I think I'm done. Yeah.